Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free pocket pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hose. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethose.com/terms.
Dr. Vertes refused to pay any attention to those facts.
It was, you know, figured out that it was a piece of pizza. We did not save the pizza to return it back to the new casket. He was buried with all kinds of medals and pins and badges and stuff like that because he was the police and fire chaplain. There was some 9/11 memorial stuff that was in there because he'd gone to Ground Zero immediately afterwards.
Understand Father Joe's suspicious death, you must first understand the corrupt nature of the Buffalo Diocese and key figures, some who remain in leadership and some who have resigned, which is a sugar-coated term for being pressured out by compiling lawsuits, protesters, and perhaps their own secrets they felt were better left hidden within the diocese closets, confessionals, and rectories. One would think that publicly being urged to resign due to knowingly protecting predators rather than victims, which subsequently affected their families and parishioners who were led to believe he was none the wiser, an ashamed man would slink into obscurity, not ask for a single thing of the church again. But that's the thing about power. When you have it and feel its addictive pleasures, you'll do anything to keep that feeling. So 2 months before Father Joe passed, the Buffalo Diocese has a new bishop appointed, Bishop Richard Joseph Malone. And on his watch, he says things are going to be handled differently.
Tonight, Buffalo officially has a new Catholic bishop. Bishop Malone is now the 14th Catholic bishop of Buffalo.
Well, of course, this all predates my arrival in the diocese. I don't know all those details. We have been going about this whole thing when an allegation comes in an entirely different way than it was done in decades past.
And sometimes in the past, and we know this is a mistake now, the verdict would be they can return to ministry. You know, we would never do that now.
Bishop Malone was given the royal treatment in Buffalo, and he moved into an 11,000-square-foot mansion with an over 4,000-square-foot guest house, where he and his buddies could do as they please. With his new position, he was able to be an agent of change. He could help stop the rampant sexual abuse in the diocese, but he chose to look the other way, deflect, blame, become a willing participant in the abuse of children and adults alike that he knew had been going on since before he even settled into his new office in that Buffalo diocese. But that was no matter because the binder that contained all of the abuse that had been covered up prior to him, he just stashed that away in a closet in his office. This closet, which contained two things, a vacuum and a binder of stories with lives forever changed by the diocese he now reigned over. But these lives have remained in a vacuum of silence, organized by the Catholic Diocese of Buffalo. humans now discarded for Bishop Malone's garden parties and demands. Though Bishop Malone claimed he would be handling cases of abuse far differently than they had been in the past, now that he was bishop beginning in August of 2012, he was perhaps handling it different for another reason. Because just one of many abuse allegations that Malone covered up showed that he actually reinstated an accused priest after a former bishop had removed him. And he covered up not only the priest's victims' reports that included an eighth grade boy whose mother and school principal acted on his behalf after it was found out that Father Art Smith had signed off a Facebook message to the eighth grade boy saying, "Love you." Principal Kristen Hyder of St. Mary of the Lake School and the boy's mom sent a letter to the former Bishop Kimmick in 2011 with a detailed account of that eighth grade boy and other students who reportedly called him the creeper and that he was grooming and stalking the boy. And Art was quick to jump at the chance to be reinstated by a new bishop. Immediately upon Malone being appointed bishop, Art Smith began writing letters to him from the church-run Rehabilitation Center for Troubled Priests that he was sent to after the incident with the eighth grader. By November of 2012, Bishop Malone had reinstated Art Smith. His letters worked. He was back in the Buffalo Diocese rotation. Bishop Malone assigned him as the chaplain of a nursing home run by the Catholic Church. And upon hearing Art Smith had been reappointed, Kristen Hyder, the school principal, wrote to the bishop upset about Art's reassignment. Bishop Malone responded that this was a lower profile position for Art at the Brothers of Mercy nursing home, and because the incident with the eighth grader didn't technically violate the American Bishop's zero tolerance policy adopted in 2012. However, even in a nursing home, Father Art Smith was accused by two young men of sexual misconduct. And due to the relentless reporting of Charlie Specht of Buffalo's Channel 7 News, many of these letters were obtained, including the letter from the head of Brothers of Mercy, which was sent to Bishop Malone, stating that they were willing to give Father Art a chance, but due to his inappropriate conduct with two employees, stating, "We regret that we must terminate Father Smith." Upon receiving this letter, allegedly Bishop Malone urged Art Smith to go back to the treatment center. Art Smith refused, and in 2014, wrote a letter to Pope Francis claiming he was a victim and that there was no basis for the claims against him, and for 42 years he has served without incident. Then in May of 2015, Bishop Malone agreed to meet with Art Smith, and they started the process of beginning to reintegrate his priestly ministry in the Buffalo Diocese. Meanwhile, the letter Art had written to Pope Francis was now on the radar of the Vatican, and they wanted to know how Bishop Malone was handling this. In a two-faced move, Bishop Malone responded to the Vatican that he had good reason to remove Art from ministry and that Art had checked himself out of the treatment center just after one day. Bishop Malone was allegedly claiming to the Vatican that he had given Art Smith swift punishment for the grooming of the eighth grader and then revealed two other incidents never reported. But then, bizarrely, ended the letter stating that on the basis of his cooperation to regular counseling, "I have granted Father Smith faculties to function as a priest in the Diocese of Buffalo." Well, he not only granted him faculties, Bishop Malone had 2 months prior written a highly favorable recommendation letter for Father Smith to a Catholic-run cruise line, endorsing him to be a chaplain aboard a cruise. Bishop Malone stated in the letter, "He is a person of good moral character. I know nothing which would in any way limit or disqualify him from this ministry. I am unaware of anything in his background which would render him unsuitable to work with minor children." This is just one of many examples of Bishop Malone carelessly covering up predator priests' actions. After years of controversy, and then mounting pressure in 2019 from thousands of Catholics in Buffalo, who did everything from praying at vigils, circulating petitions, to holding up protest signs, Bishop Malone finally resigned in December of 2019 and announced he and the diocese would sell the bishop's mansion to help compensate victims of clergy sexual abuse. But we will come to find out many of the victims never saw their settlement money. He was initially offered a newly redone rectory to live in, but said that this would not be suitable for gatherings he hosts, and said that, quote, "I prize privacy above most everything. I cannot live in a building that is used for meetings or for anything other than my residence." So he instead moved into a former convent, St. Stan's, which was even bigger than the bishop's mansion. It used to house 35 nuns. And now former Bishop Malone is living there with just him and his dog.
And showed signs of grooming and stalking the young boy. Three new allegations of sexual misconduct, when yet another allegation of sexual misconduct was reported to the diocese.
The more than 80 priests and nuns who have been accused of sexual misconduct in the last 6 months. But they've also exposed a pattern of how the Catholic Church in Buffalo treats allegations of sexual abuse.
It's important to note that all parties mentioned in this podcast are innocent until proven guilty, or may simply just be innocent. And all opinions from our various interviews are their own. When we got to Buffalo, Joe shared with us the crime scene photos he had and the photos he took during the exhumation. And these are eye-opening, and they raise so many questions.
So let's rewind back to the spring of 2015, where we left off last episode. Bishop Malone is still sleeping soundly in his bougie abode on Oakland Place. Joe Wedge has been asked to help exhume a body by a priest, Father Rob Marino. Joe says he can't turn down a favor from a priest, and he and Rob are friends after all.
Seems like he got the wind knocked out of his sails when he realized there was no gun in there and wasn't 100% sure that a second autopsy was going to turn up much information. But nonetheless, at that point, I realized that he was being sent for another autopsy to a very well-known pathologist, Dr. Cyril Wecht, who has written lots of books. He's a famous pathologist. He's like, anybody that works in pathology knows that he's like one of the best. There's him, Michael Baden, and Dr. Lee are like the top guys.
We know Dr. Cyril Wecht. We talked about this world-renowned criminal pathologist last episode, who was called in to re-examine such high-profile autopsies as Chambonnet Ramsey, Anna Nicole Smith, Brittany Murphy, and JFK.
So he was going to be doing a second autopsy. So we continued to prepare the body, and the two funeral directors. Were very quiet the whole time, and they were taking off layer by layer all of the vestments and things out of the casket and cataloging everything just so we could keep it all organized, because it was all going to be returned to the new casket that he was going to be buried in after the second autopsy. Because the casket had failed and there was a lot of water in it, there's skin slippage and things like that, and I didn't want... Like, body parts can fall off, large body parts, arms, legs, limbs, things like that. So they put a Hoyer lift on it to lift everything up all at once. Well, it didn't, you know, lift the head. So I just stepped in and I grabbed the head from behind and was going to guide it over to the table that we were putting him on to, like, clean the body off. And as the Hoyer lift went up and I lifted the head, I thought, well, this is obviously kind of light and... lighter than what I would have been used to, or lighter than what I expected from a human head. So when we moved him over, I took a closer look because I had been given the autopsy report at this point from Diane Virtus, and it was written up like a complete autopsy, and I looked at the body and looked at the funeral directors and said they could tell I was thinking the same thing. This body has not been autopsied. There is no Y incision on his chest.
Diane Vertes was the medical examiner at the time. What is very peculiar about her apparent cooperation with the Buffalo police, ruling this death a suicide with no further investigation or completing a full autopsy, is her sudden, early retirement within months after she performed Father Joe's autopsy. After pressure mounted from yet another corrupt, suspect autopsy Dr. Vertes had performed. This time it was a 20-year-old girl named Amanda Winkowski.
She had one of the top jobs in Erie County. Tonight, the chief medical examiner has suddenly resigned.
Chief medical examiner in Erie County is stepping down. The big question is why.
Dr. Diane Vertes handed in her resignation yesterday. No reason given for her resignation, but she has been at the center of controversy regarding the death of Amanda Winkowski.
Her body was found frozen in a garbage can on Spring Street in Buffalo in January of 2009. Despite defensive wounds found on her arms and legs, Diane Vertes' conclusion assumes that she OD'd on drugs and put herself in a trash can during a freezing cold Buffalo January.
Every person that comes in here has a story, and they're often very tragic stories.
Dr. Diane Vertes had spent 10 years as Erie County's chief medical examiner. Her sudden resignation has raised questions about why she left without explanation, at least to the public.
Foul play seems obvious here, similarly to Father Joe's case, which she rules a suicide just months prior to abruptly retiring. Perhaps the noise Father Joe's twin sister Sue was making with her own investigation had Dr. Vertes fearing they would exhume the body and see her shoddy, maybe even criminal, work.
She went off of what the police told her, that it was self-inflicted gunshot wound to the head. She didn't ask any more questions than that. Didn't ask for crime scene photos or anything. Anyway, so I took a closer look and I followed where, in my experience, where the incisions would have been to do a head-only autopsy. And they were mostly where I would have expected, except for on the left side, it seemed like she started further back behind the ear.
Can you explain where the nola would be?
Normally it would be from the top of the ear to top of the ear, right across the top of your skull, like right across the crown.
Got it.
So
like
that,
like a headband?
Yeah, like a headband. And that's so that you can peel the skin away from the forehead down to about the eyebrows. And then from the back of the scalp back to the base of your skull. And that's so that you can make a, you can take the bone saw and cut circular around the top of the skull and remove it like a cap. And when I had moved, when I was holding onto the head, something in the back of the head where my fingers were didn't really feel right. So I made it a mental note to measure or to point out or to take a look, closer look at why my index finger and my ring finger felt like there was something missing in between that was the about the width of my other finger, almost felt like there was two holes. So then I followed where the suture went and where the funeral home previously had patched the entry wound from behind the ear with silly putty and a couple of sutures. And I took a picture of it and then proceeded to remove some stitching. When I removed some of the stitching and peeled back and pulled the skull cap off, there was no brain.
No brain? Why would Diane Vertes not have returned the brain? Was she asked to dispose of it? After all, since there wasn't an exit wound, the brain would have been the best evidence to study the angle of the bullet track and determine if the gun had fired from a standing position or from Father Joe's own hands. Or was there something to hide that the brain revealed? Perhaps a second bullet track? Joe Wedge certainly thinks so.
What I saw was it looked like the bullet wound was too big for the skull damage, or was too small for the skull, for the amount of damage done by the skull. But it was hard to tell because it had been cut through and then sutured and approximated back together. The skin had been like a bad purse stitch where they just grabbed a whole bunch of skin, squished it together and put a couple sutures in. Like the funeral home was trying to hide another bullet wound to make it not look so obvious. But would have been like a moot point because the way he was laying in the casket, it was on the opposite side of his head from any viewing of the from the public. It wouldn't have been seen anyway. It would have been covered partially by the pillow in the casket. So it seemed like it was weird that they put that much effort into fixing a wound that in the end didn't really make much of a difference whether or not it was seen or not, because it wasn't going to be seen by the public. Knowing what I know now, yeah, it was definitely not just a bad job. Like, it wasn't a bad job. It wasn't like somebody did this and they just suck at their job.
Yeah.
It was that somebody was trying to hide something.
We re-examined the crime scene photos and the exhumation photos Joe took that day. And judging from what you can see in the crime scene photos compared to the post-autopsy photos from the exhumation, there is a very questionable second suture. And the scalp incision goes below the ear to intersect the only reported gunshot wound, which is much lower than it needs to be. And the sutures are not very well done in general. Considering this was for a priest, it just looks like something is being covered up, sewn shut, assumed to never see sunlight again. Like the wilted roses still laying on Father Joe's casket when they opened up the vault. They don't look more than a few weeks old.
I'm assuming, well, they would have taken his brain out during the autopsy of his head in order to follow the wound tract and see where, what parts of his brain were destroyed by it, what path the bullet took. Was his death instant? Was his death something where he lingered? That kind of thing. You can tell all that from the wound track. And you'd also be able to tell the position of the head when he was shot. And I mean, it would help. It could also help in things like how tall is the killer? If the person's sitting and the wound tract is this way and the person was asleep, the killer would be about this tall.
And the brain, it just goes missing? This valuable piece of evidence, and not to mention the spiritually important context to returning the mind to the body before burial? It's hard to believe Father Joe's brain going missing was anything but intentional.
It's not something you just misplace. You would have, in the procedure, you would have taken the brain out, weighed it, checked the weight, made sure it fell within the range of a normal brain, mm-hmm. and or expected it to be a little bit larger because of swelling, like the retained water from swelling, or the weight of the actual bullet that's in it, mm-hmm. assuming the bullet is in it still. Those are all things you would tell from the brain, but there are things that you would be able to examine, and then you would immediately return the brain at the end of the autopsy back into the skull, as you would the rest of the organs. You would keep the brain maybe in a specimen jar if for some reason the death was because of a poisoning or something like that, or you had suspicions that you might need the brain for further testing. Something physical, like a traumatic brain injury, you wouldn't keep the brain out. There's nothing more that you're going to get from it that you wouldn't have gotten right then and there. Measurements, things like that. So you would have returned it.
So they just throw the brain away?
No, they never would just throw the brain away right away. Maybe 6-8 months if they realized we kept the brain, we really didn't need it, we would toss it. They're not going to go dig up the body to put the brain back in. But a lot of times it's also, the other reason that it's always returned is for religious reasons. You want the body to be buried as intact as possible, or everything that goes with that body should go with that body. A motive to keep the brain and not return it to the skull, that would have been the way to prove that there was the second gunshot wound. So now there is no way to definitively prove that a second shot was taken.
Joe Wedge has put our jaws on the floor. There appears to be a second gunshot wound, and the brain was never returned to the body, which could have easily proven the manner of death. The photos after the exhumation clearly show a second hole sutured shut. It would have been hard to see, as it is hidden by Father Joe's hair in the crime scene photos. But Joe Wedge discovered this upon examining the exhumed body while holding Father Joe's head in his hands. Noted this and made sure to photograph it clearly. And while we can't say it is for sure a bullet wound, there is certainly a second hole that is sutured shut.
You wouldn't draw attention to it. You would dispose of it, and then you could say, that way you could preserve your, it was an accident or it was misplaced. Evidence is misplaced all the time.
That's true, but, I could see how, everyone has human error, but a brain...
And I know, losing a brain sounds like something that, what idiot would lose a brain? I mean, if you ever worked in pathology, there are body parts everywhere in that part of the lab. Arms, legs, from amputations, voluntary or not. organs that are removed during procedures, sections of organs that are removed, they're all, box cataloged. And then once you're done with them in pathology, you toss them. You might keep them just in case a doctor comes back and says, I don't like the sample, I don't like the result, I don't believe the pathologist, for whatever reason, so that they can go get another tissue sample and test for tumor, things like that.
But in this case,
it's one of those things that, why did you keep the brain out? She's an idiot. And how do you lose a brain? At this point, I didn't have all the facts. So I was trying to reconcile it for myself that, maybe she had to have had a reason for it, for keeping the brain. Maybe there was some other, testing she was going to do on it, and I couldn't think of any, but, I'm not her. I wasn't there, what her thought process was. So I moved on, and I made some notes, took some measurements, and, wrote it down for Dr. Wecht, because my notes were going to accompany the body with Father Robert and his sister Sue, who were transporting the body, not themselves, but they were following the van down to Pittsburgh, where Dr. Wecht was going to do the second autopsy. So we cleaned up the body and everything, and he was placed in a body bag with all the evidence. It was zip-tied and sealed so that in transport it should still be sealed by the time it gets to Dr. Wecht, so that there's no tampering with the body or anything like that, and it's all for chain of custody. So we all initialed, the tag that seals the body bag, and then it went on its way. I didn't accompany the body. I wasn't planning to accompany the body, and Father Robert hadn't asked me to, and plus, I had to go back to work that day. I went, this literally was almost on my lunch break. I had taken half a day, and I worked that morning, gone to work that morning, and left to take care of this, and Father Robert also had mentioned to me at the very beginning, don't tell anybody where you're going or what you're doing.
Can you imagine exhuming a body on your lunch break in secret? How would you go back to work and keep a straight face?
Partly because it was involved in the church and they're shady they don't have the best track record. And then I had said to Father Robert, I said, you'll be calling me later because we need to talk. And he said, yeah, I'll call you tonight. And he called me the next day, and I said, he goes, I need a favor. And I said, I'm still waiting for therapy from the last favor you asked me. And I said, he said, we'll meet up. And he said, I thought that your involvement was going to be just this. And he goes, I think you might be helpful in some other places. So he said, there's going to be a meeting. And he said, tell Phil, don't tell Phil, that was my husband. And he said, I'll leave that up to you. And I jokingly said, you're a priest. Are you really telling me to lie to my husband? And he said, I didn't say that. So I told him where I was going, and my husband took the less known the better kind of stance. And he knew he would start asking questions if he felt like Father Robert and I got into something that we shouldn't be. Not that it would have stopped us, but we had a meeting a couple of days later. I think it was a couple of days or a week or two later at Sue's house, and that was where I actually met Sue for the first time. And at that point, there was several people that were all involved in this, some older people from the church, just basically people that were adamant that he didn't kill himself.
Were they at the meeting?
They were all at the meeting. And
what
then
year was this?
This was 2015.
Okay.
Spring of 2015, because he had been on the ground 2.5 years. Yes, spring of 2015. And I didn't realize that I was going to be like the focus of this meeting, and I sat down and everybody was talking, and there was introductions, and Father Robert kind of told everybody why I was there and what I had found. And I, at this point, I just assumed everybody knew that, you know, he didn't kill himself, and that was why this thing had, you know, these people had convened this council, if you will. And they were more upset because there was no murder weapon found, and they expected that. And somebody had brought up, one of the women had brought up, well, why did we really just disturb his final resting place? We got no information from this. And I stopped and I said, well, we got a lot of information. Basically, there's no way he killed himself. I said, regardless of whether or not he was able to manipulate his hand, being 300 plus pounds, in a recliner with limited use of his left hand, even if he still had just a little bit of a deficit in the use of his left hand, he still couldn't have done this. I said, there's no way, in no position, he would have been able to do this. I said, plus, generally, you get shot in the head, you're not going to get that second shot off. Because at that point, I was positive there was a second bullet wound. It's the only reason that it would have been sutured that way, mm-hmm. would be to cover it up.
And I believe Joe Wedge. There is a second bullet hole. I mean, come on. This can't be a suicide. We will hear more theories on what was used to end Father Joe's life as this season unfolds, and dive much deeper into the gun, the ballistics, and why the cops didn't do any ballistics testing.
They were far enough apart that she made the incision pass through the one bullet hole. Therefore, when she approximated the skin back together, or the funeral home did it, it made the bullet hole disappear. Knowing nobody at the funeral home, a parishioner or whoever, anybody that goes to the funeral is going to stick their finger in there and move the skin around and see if they can feel another hole in the skull. It would have only been found if somebody physically touched or held onto the skull. I was the first person to touch the skull after the funeral home had put him in the casket. They were interested in what I had to say, and I said, plus I was reviewing the autopsy report, and they had done a toxicology on him. Because according to his medical chart, he was on some thyroid medication, all of which I would have expected to see in a tox report, in a tox screener, his blood work. The only thing that showed up in his blood work was diphenhydramine, which is Benadryl. And I had asked Sue, I said, did he have allergies? And she said, no. And I said, would he have been taking Benadryl for any reason? And she said, not that I can think of. And I just made sure that was noted, that there was diphenhydramine in his system. Oh, I don't know if maybe he was drugged or somebody had maybe slipped it to him or put it in something. Apparently, he was well known to fall asleep anywhere.
Because he has a thyroid problem.
He's got a thyroid problem. Yeah. He keeps odd hours. He's up all the time. He's a bigger guy. He's not in the greatest health. And that he had a tendency to fall asleep when he sat down anywhere. But if you had somebody who had that kind of lifestyle and was known for that, you could give them Benadryl to ensure that they're going to fall asleep.
From the crime scene photos, it almost appears as if Father Joe had planned to take a nap. His glasses are neatly folded on the floor next to him. His collar is undone. His legs are crossed and he is hunched to one side like he peacefully slipped into a slumber. There are incongruencies with the crime scene photos that don't add up too. Like, where is the blood spatter? The windowsill, not even 2 feet from his head next to the recliner, does not even have a drop of blood on it. The wall, completely clean. There is not even blood on the headrest of the recliner, just oozing out of his ear. And there was no blood on the gun. The only photo of the gun is in an evidence bag, so perhaps the police had wiped it off. Also suspicious, but not improbable, after hearing how disorganized and chaotic the crime scene was from Joe's sister, Sue, who we will hear from next episode, where she describes arriving at St. Lawrence Parish on the afternoon of October 13th, 2012.
Because it's the second autopsy, and any medical examiner is going to be really, really reluctant to overturn a previous medical examiner's findings. It's just like a code. You don't mess with another surgeon's work kind of thing. And, like, Dr. Wecht would have, not him personally, because he would be skeptical, being him, but any other medical examiner would think in the back of their mind, well, this other medical examiner must have had more information than I do that she ruled it a suicide. Like, there was a video or something like that. Clearly she was wrong, but come to find out. So I started asking questions of, well, why did she rule it a suicide? Why haven't you gone to the medical examiner and asked her to reevaluate the case or change her ruling? And they said, oh, well, we've done that, and she won't do it because she said he could have done it, and that the police said it was a suicide. And then I thought about it, I said, so she's basing her findings off of what the police said. She didn't have to put on there self-inflicted. She did. She put self-inflicted gunshot wound. She could have put gunshot wound to the head and cause undetermined or origin undetermined. Then I was certain of it years later when another case came about that made news, made headlines in the news, because anybody with one iota of common sense would have said, no, this young girl did not accidentally overdose herself, and she was found in a, this girl was found in a dumpster naked in the wintertime, head first into a garbage tote. This medical examiner, Diane Verdi, she ruled this young girl's death an accidental overdose when it was blatantly obvious to anybody who knew even some of the facts of how she was found. I can't come up with any kind of scenario where you accidentally do that to yourself.
So we have Dr. Diane Verdes, the medical examiner who without explanation retires in a cloud of ill repute from another botched autopsy where she took the police's word for it and proceeded to make the death certificate match the Buffalo police's facts. This reality gives credence to everything Joe Wedge is telling us about Father Joe's body in the spring of 2015, after being dug up to be sent to Dr. Cyril Wecht for a second look.
Her daughter, Christina, was there also, who was Father Joe's niece. And they gave me a package of information to look over, basically showing me this is also why we don't think he killed himself, because I was going based on the medical facts at that point. Based on just the medical facts alone, I didn't think he committed suicide. And then after reading all the information that they gave me at that time, which was his schedule, things he did, what were his days leading up to it, his financial status, all that stuff, that just solidified it for me that this man did not kill himself. You know, as this investigation went on, we found more and more reasons why he didn't get along with certain other priests and why the higher-ups in the diocese gave him a hard time. They bullied him, basically. So we had that meeting, and then I talked to Father Rob a couple of days later, and we sort of, over the course of years, we would pull each other aside whenever we saw each other for things like my ex-husband playing a mass at his church or funeral or wedding. Anytime he just stopped over, he would come over for dinner, things like that. We'd take 5 minutes and go talk and, you know, do you have any new information? Do you have any new information? We'd exchange anything and we'd make sure that we kept each other in the loop.
Joe was committed to finding out more. He couldn't let this go. He was dragged into this mess by his friend, Father Rob. and Joe was an unbiased third party. But after his experience at the exhumation, a little bit of research, and meeting Father Joe's family, still fighting for justice, Joe Wedge felt a duty to empower their pursuit of the truth. He also shared with us personal stories of why suicide was not something he could let this family live with if their son, brother, uncle had not taken his own life.
When somebody commits suicide, their pain doesn't end. Their pain just gets put on everybody else.
And that was so unlike Father Joe's character to burden others.
Hi, I'm Richard Karn, and you may have seen me on TV talking about the world's number one expandable garden hose. Well, the brand new Pocket Hose Copperhead with Pocket Pivot is here, and it's a total game changer. Old-fashioned hoses get kinks and creases at the spigot, but the Copperhead's Pocket Pivot swivels 360 degrees for full water flow and freedom to water with ease all around your home. When you're all done, this rust-proof anti-burst hose shrinks back down to pocket size for effortless handling and tidy storage. Plus, your super light and ultra-durable pocket hose Copperhead is backed with a 10-year warranty. What could be better than that? I'll tell you what, an exciting exclusive offer just for you. For a limited time, you can get a free Pocket Pivot and their 10-pattern sprayer with the purchase of any size Copperhead hose. Just text WATER to 64000. That's WATER to 64000 for your two free gifts with purchase. W-A-T-E-R to 64000.
By texting 64000, you agree to receive recurring automated marketing messages from Pocket Hosts. Message and data rates may apply. No purchase required. Terms apply. Available at pockethosts.com/terms.
Yeah, a couple of weeks after the exhumation, I'd say within about a month after the exhumation, Father Rob calls me out of the blue at work one day and said, well, it didn't take long for them to figure that out. And I said, what? He said, well, they must know that the diocese must know that I've been sniffing around and that I've, you know, been speaking with Sue, who made waves over her brother's death. And I said, well, why? And he said, I've been transferred. And he said, and it's actually, I'm looking at it as a good thing because I get away from, and he used to refer to him as that son of a bitch, but he was going to be getting away from Father David Broviak at St. Philip the Apostle, who he did not like, did not get along with. I never really got the story on why. I just assumed that if this person wasn't liked by Father Robert, they're a shit. But my husband's mother and father, who were both parishioners at this church, didn't like that priest either.
This is how the diocese does things. They banish them, isolating and ostracizing disobedient priests in a parish where they can keep a watchful eye on them, far removed from the problem the diocese is covering up. So they sent Father Rob to Coventry because he and Sue were making too much noise. They thought this would fracture his ties with Sue and Joe, but it only made the priest more determined. He went to interview the cops with Sue, and he was the one doing the interrogating. He remained a loyal friend to Sue and to Joe Wedge, and the testament of this friendship can be told in this anecdote from Joe, describing how Father Rob was able to convince his former husband's staunch Catholic mother to accept Joe and her son Phil's love.
He was actually integral in getting me accepted by Phil's parents because he counseled Phil's mother and by counsels, her got her drunk, and spoke with her about, you know, he told me, I asked him one day, I said, how did you convince her to, accept me? And he goes, I got her drunk. And I said, well, no, really. And he said, I got her drunk and told her, you have one choice. It's either a relationship with your son and you accept Joe, or you have no more relationship with your son. He said, because I've met them, they're not going anywhere, and that I was a good guy, and I thought, oh, he's so nice. And then, Phil's mother totally corroborated that story years later. She's like, oh, yeah, he got me drunk, and the words she said was, he got me drunk. He was a good guy. Him and I, at one point, 2 years after, or a year and a half after this all started, some other information had come to light. The three guys that were seen on tape, Sue was able to obtain through the Freedom of Information Act and other requests and then some thefts, that she was able to obtain a lot more information. All these other sources. So at that point, the investigation kind of became, we know he didn't kill himself, but why did somebody kill him? And who could have killed him? Who had motives?
If we go back to Father Joe's death in October of 2012, and consider what we now know about Bishop Malone's prone habit to cover up abuse, and take into account that he had just taken office 2 months earlier, there lies motive to silence a whistleblower sitting on top of the diocesan food chain. We know that there was a fierce argument between Father Joe and multiple clergy, including Auxiliary Bishop Grosch, the night before he died. So early into Bishop Malone's new post, I wonder if Auxiliary Bishop Grosch was doing Malone's bidding that night, delivering Father Joe an ultimatum. Did the diocese know he was meeting with the papal nuncio from Rome in D.C. 3 days later? Fast forward to January 2019. The diocese decides to sell the bishop's mansion to offset costs on legal settlements to victims of clergy sex abuse. This will prove to be a key ingredient to our story, momentarily. This is from a Channel 7 news report. Buffalo, New York. Buffalo Bishop Richard J. Malone has found a buyer for his palatial mansion on Oakland Place. Buffalo Diocese spokeswoman Kathy Spangler confirmed Thursday that the mansion is under contract but would not identify the potential buyer. "We will not disclose details until it has closed," she said in an email.
Joe Wedge was chauffeuring us around all day long while we were knocking on rectory doors and investigating, and I really had to use the restroom at this point. Initially, we were going to pull over at a pharmacy, but oftentimes those places don't have bathrooms, so I said, "Do you know of a restaurant nearby?" And Joe was like, "Oh yeah, there's this really cool gay bar right down the street, and we could get a drink." So we walk into this bar, I use the bathroom, and then we come back and we sit down. And then we decide to make an announcement to the room.
This was a gay bar in Buffalo on a Tuesday at 4 p.m. There are only 4 or 5 patrons, and I unceremoniously interrupt their happy hour, asking aloud, "Does anyone here know about Father Joe Moreno or the corruption in the Catholic Diocese of Buffalo?" After a brief record scratch, a gentleman across the bar, looks to be in his 40s, pipes up and says, "I bought the bishop's mansion." What?
"It wasn't always the former bishop's mansion. It was a private house. We're the second private owner." "Another one?"
"I think I will, but I'm going to have it down there."
Joe Wedge, Rachel, and I flock to his side of the bar top, laden him with questions and attempt to buy him a drink in exchange for an interview.
So, you lead.
We've got a true crime podcast.
Did we really just meet the new owner of the bishop's mansion in a gay bar in Buffalo? All because Rachel had to pee. We were guided into this dive and serendipitously struck up a conversation with this wonderful man, a man we would visit again in Buffalo, and who would become our friend.
"Well, of course he is. Of course, they've got, that's the Catholic Church. It's been like that forever. I mean, the old popes years and years ago, they were murderers."
This is Stephen Dietz. He used to work as an accountant for the Catholic Church. He's seen some things. He knows a lot of secrets we can't tell on this podcast. And he has some thoughts on Bishop Malone.
"I think he is a homophobic person, yes, I do.
I'm surprised he's not killing
him. Because his big campaign in the Diocese of Portland, Maine, was deadly, opponent of gay marriage, gay rights of any kind. He says that he'll be inclusive as long as they don't practice homosexuality. Well, you have no right to dictate anything, number one. The church is so antiquated that way. I think basically that's what it is, because he wants to rise up in the Catholic Church hierarchy, so you play the game. It's like anything else. It's the church is just like any other corporation or whatever, you rise up.
And he tells us about what he found in Malone's mansion before he and his partner bought it.
You should have seen this stuff. This is a great story.
Was Malone in it right before you?
No, he had left. He had left about 5 months before we looked at it.
Tell them about the alcohol.
That's just what I'm going to tell him, Mike.
Okay.
I was just going to tell him about that. Yes. So we went. It was a November day in 2018, and we went across the street and. The diocese real estate guy was there, had them all, real estate for the diocese. So he let us in, very nice guy. And, you know, so we're walking around, and then we get to the servant side of the house, which is the servants had a dining room. Mrs. Foreman put the servant's dining room. It was a butler's pantry, a maid's pantry, and the kitchen.
Okay.
And then there was the butler's bedroom and bathroom.
Did Malone actually have servants and stuff? No, he did not.
Okay. That was the way it was built originally.
Yeah.
So he just had cleaning ladies come in and a cook, and you know, but they didn't live there. Where when the house was built, it was built for living.
A cook.
Yeah.
Okay, Richie Rich.
Yeah. So my partner and I went into the butler's pantry, which. It's quite commodious. So we go in, and there were like two or three 55-gallon garbage cans sitting in around the place. And on the counters all the way around, there were like every kind of booze. It looked like this.
Are you serious?
No, pause. I'm telling you the truth. And they couldn't fit them all in the 55-gallon drum, so they had to smash them. So they'd throw them in the drums, and then they had this big thing, and they would smash the glass down to fit more bottles in.
This sounds like a scene you would find in a frat house, not at the bishop's mansion. Clearly, there was some debauchery going down behind the closed doors of 77 Oakland Place. Rachel, Steve, Joe, and I share stories and drinks dissecting the Catholic Diocese of Buffalo and beyond until we realized... We're supposed to have dinner with the Morenos in a few minutes. But that's for next episode. Thank you for listening, and if you have a tip, don't hesitate to reach out. Our tip line email is deadlydiocese@gmail.com. Or you can reach out to us through the Seven Deadly Sinners Instagram.